So for today, I wanted to talk about an extension of the machine model that we have introduced last time. So if you think back, our machine model was quite a simple one where we modeled separate threads as separate processes in our process diagram, and we have generously given the memory the property of being able to answer requests for particular variables concurrently. So the memory was able to answer to different queries at the same time, so to say. So for now, we have seen that that is one very simple model, and the thing that that bothers us at most with that model is that we always have this pretty costly communication with this centralized instance, the memory. And round trips to the memory, there and back again, last quite for a long time, so they cost a lot of CPU cycles. So in order to get a more decent runtime, the idea was to introduce caches, which are kind of quite small local memories for each of the cores, where they can store the portion of the memory that they are actually working with for a short amount of time. And the thing is that they only have to go to the memory once to actually fetch the memory line, place them in their own cache, and if they have subsequent accesses to the same memory address, which would be variables for our model, then these requests can be answered through the own cache instead of the main memory, which would have a much faster access time than just the plain memory. However, there is still the problem that you have to somehow deal with processes accessing, in principle, one shared memory space. So in case that they actually address the same memory areas and want to read from the same variables, they will both end up with having a copy of this variable in each of their own caches. So that is now a different situation. We have to model more different entities there. There's the memory, which we will, we'll see what we will do with the memory itself. But we will have the caches as each of them their own process line for each of their cache lines. And our simplification for our model was that we will model each cache line for one particular variable access. So there's no sharing of cache lines for variables, which is one of the properties that actual real caches have, but it's still sufficient for us to have that model in order to run into a few problems. So we'll see. But in order to re-establish some way of some notion of what it means when we talk about correct programs, we have several instances of the same variables flying around in our model, then we should think about a way to somehow make sure that we can access these variables in a consistent way. And the way to do that is the so-called MESI protocol. Not to confuse with the MESI, the one that's all things flying around, but who of you has not heard yet of the MESI protocol? Okay, is there actually anyone who has already heard about that? Ah, there are even a few. Okay, so where do you know that from? Have you read in some kind of documentation, or is it in some other lecture? Which one? Is it this introductory microprocessors course, or is it some kind of more advanced one? It's the second one. Part two. Okay, so I've started a long time ago, and for me it was kind of, what was it called? High performance computing or something, where we actually heard about that for the first time. But that was back then when we all had Unicore processor machines, and several cores were already high performance in that. Well, anyway, so MESI protocol is the idea to introduce a system which would ensure that we can still talk about consistent memory accesses. And I've already told you about this idea of introducing caches in order not to have to do costly round trips to the memory. And if you access them repeatedly, well, more often than just once, you will benefit from having these cache lines near to you. The name MESI is actually just using the abbreviations of the particular states that are introduced in this protocol for each of the cache lines. So a cache line is assumed to have a certain state, and each of these cache lines is marked with such state. And as we have MESI, it's the four states M, E, S, and I. Maybe you can help me with the lectures, with the ones who have already been in such lectures. What does M stand for? So M would mean modified. Yes, correct. Thumbs up, yeah. Okay. Yes?
E is for exclusive.
We have exclusive.
S is for shared.
Shared. Okay. And I? Invalid. Correct. So these are the four states of our cache lines now. And so invalid means there's no consistent data there. It might have been some meaningful cache line in the past, but has been outdated or for some reason discarded and is now ready to be used again. So that is this state of the line. Then there's the state S, which is shared. So this means that there's other caches of other cores somewhere else which have an identical copy of exactly this cache line, thus the meaning shared. So that's this. Then there's exclusive. Exclusive means that there is valid content in that actual cache line. However, this particular cache line is not present in any of the other caches, thus exclusive. Then there's modified, which means that there has been some transformations on that or some modifications in that cache line. For that to be a valid thing, this content must have been somehow exclusive to that particular cache line before it was able to become modified. So, yeah, that's modified. And within this protocol, there's transitions between the particular cache line states. So you can, for example, go from the exclusive state to the modified state by a certain transition. Well, they're just labeled arbitrarily here, but you can do so by modifying that particular cache line with a write access to the variable that is associated with that line. So that is an example for a way of how to switch from one state to another. So all in all, we now somehow need to come up with a system to specify how to have the transitions between the states in order to keep a sequentially consistent system, although we introduce states now. So you can not only have local transitions in the sense that you somehow write to a cache line, but you can instead also exchange transitions with other cores so that you will be able to synchronize on the validity of that specific cache line by sending messages over a common message bus. So there's certain messages in the MESI protocol, and depending on the actual architecture that we're looking at, there might be a few others that I just optimized away from not overwhelming you, so, but the most basic ones are the ones that you will find here. So there's the one of them, which is for, yeah, for, well, we were actually, I think all of those that we have listed here are the ones that go from one cache to another cache. So these are these communication messages between the different cores. So there's the read request, which is issued by a particular CPU if that CPU doesn't have this specific cache line in a valid state. So this will issue a read for a certain address. That is one thing that is then put out to the message bus. And depending on where the actual information for that particular address is actually kept, we will get a read response. So that is the particular answer to that. And well, as it is the read response, it will always be issued following a read, and it has well, it has, it can carry the answer with it. So it carries the data that is that was requested, and yeah, depends on who the actual holder of that information at that. That situation is, we will issue this read response. So there are several cases which can occur. Let's say, for example, that we have you have two CPUs, and one issues the read request. It doesn't have the information. The other one has it. Let it be an exclusive or shared state's cache line. Anyway, if this other CPU has information about this memory address, it will then issue the read response on the message bus. Thus, the original the CPU which issued the read will get the response, and yeah. That's that for that case. And there's the other case that there's no other CPU around which has the appropriate cache line. Well, what will happen then? So the memory is actually another participant in this whole chain. It also sits on the same bus, and it is also able to issue messages here, and the memory is also able to issue the read response. It also gets all the other messages that are on the bus. It's just it's a bus, so everyone sees everything. So, yeah. And the idea is here to have this kind of hierarchy in access speeds, so that in case one of the other CPUs has this information, it will be connected to the original CPU with a very fast interconnection. And the lookup speed in its own cache is also quite fast. So the if there is a another CPU that has the information, it will be able to respond much quicker than the memory has. So the memory, what it will do is when it realizes that there's a read going on, it will start to look up the particular data anyway. But in case that there is a read response from another core, it just doesn't bother anymore with finishing with that response, but can just discard that specific request. And in case that there's no other CPU that can deliver this this read response quick enough, then there at one point the memory will then issue the read response, and this will arrive in well very much later on. So that's this idea of having these hierarchies in that system. So what one has to remember, memory is also participant of this communication process, and it's also connected to the bus, and it is a valid partner to cooperate with. Then, next thing, we're not only wanting to read from data, but we might also want to write from write into some kind of cache line. In that case, what we're going to do is we want to inform the other participants that I'm actually performing an update on that specific cache line, so it makes sense for the others to discard their view on that particular cache line. So what we do is we will then, as the process who intends to write at a certain cache line, it will issue an invalidate message that this asks all the other participants to evict that particular cache line, and the others will try to do so, and in case that they have received that message, they will answer with an invalidate acknowledgement. So they indicate that the process who intends to write that particular cache line will be able to do so. So this is the invalidate acknowledgement. And yeah, then there's one special message, which is a kind of a combination of the ones that we have had before, which is this read invalidate. That is a combination of the other two. That is a process wants to write into a cache line which isn't yet present for that particular process. So what it needs to do is it needs to first get the particular cache line in order to be able to write into that. So what it will do is it will send out the read invalidate message, and the one who receives that thing will then answer with, at first, will answer with two messages. It will send the read response. Oh, yeah, that's not the place to mark that. So it will answer with the read response at first. That's while it still has the actual cache line, and then it will continue with evicting that cache line, and if it has done so, it will send out this invalidate acknowledgement. So, yeah, that's a special case. And then there's, in the end, also another thing, which is a little bit different than before, which is this write-back thing. This is a message that informs the memory that at that point the cache controller has decided that the cache line at that point is will maybe not be needed anymore, but has still modifications in there. And if it has still modifications in there, it cannot be discarded because, well, the information would have been lost. So what needs to be done is the main memory needs to be informed that the data needs to be actually modified in the main memory. So it will issue a write-back message on the bus with together with the most recent value for that cache line and send it back to main memory. Okay, so these are the things that we will see in our communications later on. So, any questions about that? Yeah?
Is anything allowed to happen between the read response and validate acknowledgement that will be triggered by the written validate?
There might be delays, for example, if the bus is busy with other messages concerning other lines, maybe. You have to wait for the invalidate acknowledge because there might still be something else happening. Yeah. Good. Okay. So this is a little bit much if we just have it in theory. So we will consider an example here now for how that might turn out to work. So let's have a look at a particular setup. We have two threads, thread A and thread B, and they are trying to somehow synchronize via shared memory. And what they do is they have variable A and B. I think it's the same example that we had last time. So thread A writes first A, then B, and thread B listens to changes for variable B, and in case this B is somehow changed, then it tries to do something with A, and it's only correct when A is actually showing the changes that have been done on that by thread A. So that is kind of, you can consider B to be somewhat like a flag that my modification to A has finished at that point. So that is the intention of this type of communications. And yeah, so for our modeling so far, what we can suppose is that we have, well, the initial values of our variables would be zero. We suppose that A and B reside in caches now. However, they reside in different cache lines. And in order for these invalidate things to be somewhat meaningful, I think we also have to assume that a cache line is larger than the variable itself, but we still have them residing in different cache lines. So yeah, that's kind of some way to make it fit to a concrete memory model. But anyway, what's more important for me now is to introduce the way that we annotate the states for the MESI protocol in our process system. So for that, we introduce some kind of markers that we put on the process lines in order to make sure that we remember the actual state that that particular line is in, because we'll get a lot of lines. So we will use MX as a marker for modified with a value X. We will use E and S accordingly. So E is exclusive with value X, S is shared with value X, and for I, well, there's no actual meaningful value, so we'll just use I for that. Good. So then looking at our examples, we will have, we will always have to somehow arrange that we will have a known start. For us, that will mean that we have the states invalid for all the cache lines for now, and the values 0 and 0 for the variables A and B in main memory. So that's for now the initial state of the whole system. That might be completely different depending on the actual history of what the processors have done before, so there might be other configurations, but that is our initial configuration for now. So then for something like the instruction A1, which is this one, to work, we intend to write to variable A from thread A. So we have to look into this column here for CPU A and first consider whether we actually have the cache line present or not. And looking that up, we will see that this thing is invalid in the initial state. So in order to execute A1 on an invalid state, what we want to do is we will read, but we want to modify at the same time. So that's why we issue this read invalidate message from CPU A. And what will happen is we will receive an invalidate acknowledgement from CPU B. Well, that's easy for CPU B to issue because it's still it's invalid anyway. And we will after a long time get the read response from the RAM for the value of A. So we actually get this thing, and we can, at that point of time, we will have somewhat the exclusive version of that cache line. But as we intend to overwrite anyway, we will switch to the modified state. That depends on the amount of detail that you want to put into the modeling. In principle, you would have two separate states and an event happening in between. So you get the cache line, then you modify it. But for our purposes, it's completely sufficient to immediately consider the cache line as modified with the new value as soon as it arrives. But that depends on what you want to do with the whole thing. So it might also... it might not be sufficient for certain purposes. For ours, it's completely fine. So we will consider the new state of that cache line now as modified and with the value 1. So what we will then do is we will continue with the next instruction, which is this B1. It's still in... No. Okay. B1 is, of course... associated with B, so it should be that particular thing that's happening there. So we want to look up the value of the variable B. And now we're in thread B. So scheduling has somehow decided that we want to execute this one next. For that, we will have to read the value of B, and this will be the message that was issued from B, because, well, locally we don't have an understanding of how B actually looks like, so it will it's invalid. So after that it's still invalid, but then in the end we will after a long time we will get the response from RAM, which says read response with B0, and with that we will actually then know the value of B, and we can enter that in here. And as we only read but not modified, we will have this value exclusively now. So we go to state E0. Yeah. So let's see what's up for us next. B1, well, as the whole thing is a loop, it might repeat a few times, so we will once again get to the statement where we just check the value of B. And now, well, as we have this B locally in our cache, we can check it without issuing any messages, so there's just no message over here. But instead, what we can do is we can look it up locally, and well, that won't change anything in our cache states. It's still exclusively zero in there. So that might be repeated a few times until the at some point we get that the next thing to execute is actually A2. So let's continue with A2. This is the store to variable B. So yeah, it's thread A's column which we have to check. Let's have a look at the value for B. It's invalid, so we already know what happens. It's just the same combination from combination. It's the same beginning as here. So we have the read invalidate from CPU A. However, in this case, there everything stays the same. This time it's the case that we actually have another core which has information about that particular cache line. So that is the cache for CPU B, and it has information about that value. It's zero, and it has this information exclusively. But as the other one requests information about that, it will perform its read response message and answer the value to B, or will post the read response to the message bus. So that CPU A will get an idea about the value of the whole thing. And as this was a read response from another core, process A or CPU A knows that this is now shared information. It's not obtained from the memory, so it's not exclusive, but shared. And also, as CPU B has answered a read response, it knows that it's not exclusively the one who keeps the information about the cache line, so it will also change the state of that particular cache line to shared. So it goes from exclusive at only one cache line to shared at both cache lines. Good. Apart from that, after that, we had a read invalidate message. So yeah, first we have shared the information. Now we have to evict it. So yeah, that's what CPU will do immediately after. So it will then issue a new message and change the state of the cache line to invalid, and then as soon as this message arrives, we will modify the cache line to state modified and value 1. So we can then see what scheduler has for us in the back. Then this scheduling says we have to look at B1. Well, B1 says is the check of the variable, and in this case we have a kind of similar situation as we had before. We are interested in a value which resides in another cache line. First of all, we do a read if we don't have it in our own, so that's caused by this one. And in our case, then we will have the information in CPU A's cache. It is also modified. So in case that the a modified information needs is queried from another processor or CPU, we have a problem. We can't go to the shared state immediately with the same measurements by just responding to the other CPU, because if we would do so, we would have to go to shared state, and we couldn't differentiate between the situation where we just have distributed knowledge about a certain memory cell and the situation where we have distributed a modified version of the of that particular cache line. So we So we need to somehow make sure that the actual update that is done is not lost to the complete system. Because if we would start losing interest in that particular cache line and at some point the cache controller would try to evict that cache line, well, then we would run into loss of data there because there's just no connection to the main memory. So we must make sure that the main memory is aware of a change in the value of that particular variable. So what we'll do there is we won't answer with a read response. That would be the normal way to do that. We will instead answer with a write back. Remember, that is the answer that, or the message that transmits information that there has to be something going on with writing to the memory, and the memory sits on this in the same bus and will receive that message and somehow store information about this variable then in its long-lasting processes somewhere in its memory. So we will issue a write back message, and the other CPU is able to snoop that and use that for its own cache line. So now that we have made sure that the memory is aware that it actually has to do something, we can then safely switch over to the state shared one over here, and the other CPU can then also accept this new value as shared one and continue on. So now that we have one in there, the loop then is actually broken. The guard here is not fulfilled anymore, and we can then safely pass over to the next thing. So that will be the execution of B2, and what's happening in there? Well. We will query for A, and as we don't have information for A at CPU B, which is this one here, we will issue a read, which won't change anything at first, but then there will be the answer about that, and we see process A has also done its changes on cache line for A, so we will once again get a write back of A1 and be able to switch to state shared over here and state shared over here, and we're done with that thing. Okay, so that is a lot of columns and lines and cache states in there. It maybe helps a little bit and it makes it more intuitive to talk about that. Oh, sorry, I didn't get. One slide before?
Yes.
This one.
The very first.
The intent.
Not an invalidate be enough because I don't need the value.
Yeah, that's why we have this part over here. We say, assume that a cache line is larger than the variable itself.
Sorry.
You're quicker than most people who asked that question in the past. So, the thing is, I have to issue this read with intention to validate, because in reality, such a cache line is longer than just one variable. And in case that we want to make an update, we can always at some point we will have this write back to memory, and this will write back the complete cache line. And in case that I just want to read at that particular variable, I don't know the rest of the cache line that will then become overwritten in the memory. So I need to have the context, the rest of the cache line, in order to just make that particular change. So that's why I have to issue this read with intention to validate, to first get the cache line to be able to fill my slot with my updated value, and then write back the whole cache line once again. So, yeah. That's what why I was huddling over that at that point of time, because it may not have been intuitive why we need to assume that, but that's the cause for the read invalidate. Good. So in the happened before model, we can we now finally arrived at the thing that I wanted to do with you all the time. So there's the model for the cache with having the cache modeled as two separate lines for each of the variables. Are what?
Can we assume that the cache or the caches always answer faster than the RAM for a read response?
Yes.
How can we do that?
Sorry?
RAM can be busy doing something else with numbers and be slower?
The cache is really by dimensions faster than the RAM. So it's a matter of times 10 cycles that are in there. Well, the cache controller themselves are separate entities, so they can they do the communication stuff separate to the. It's more a question of congestion of the actual message bus. So that's situations when you get such a congested message bus that you at some point reach the dimensions of the time that is needed by the memory to answer the thing, then the memory might join the fun and also answer these things, but that's usually not the case. Good. So this column solution was quite tedious, we can instead move over to this notation over here, which we had before, which is this process diagram thing, where we have processes for each of the actual threads, which is this A and B, and process lines for each of the cache lines that we are going to use throughout our modeling. And I have the diagrams here that already carry the appropriate messages. These were the messages from the last column of the table, and I've just connected them to the events at the particular process lines. However, what I don't have here is the states of the cache lines. So that would be something that need to be added to these things, and we can do so like that. So the each cache line one process a cache is B0 as exclusive. So in A we have exclusive 0 for B, and B caches exclusively A as 0, like that. So these are different situations as the ones that we had before for the other example. And if we have exclusive information about these cache lines, then, well, if A is exclusive for this, it must be invalid here, and if B is exclusive to A, then it must be invalid here. So these are the initial states. Now let's see what to do when we have changes to these things. So here is the write access to A over here. So this will go over to the line for A in this cache. It is invalid, so what we will issue is a read invalidate. This will then share the information for a short amount of time with a shared zero. So we will come to a point where we see shared zero over here. And then we will come to invalidate acknowledgement. In order to do so, we will also need to... Oh, sorry, this was misleading probably. The shared zero is actually after we have answered the or after we have sent the message read response, and the invalidate acknowledgement goes out, and only then we have invalid as the new state on that line, while over here we will come to a modified state. Modified one, and yeah.
Is
That's the changes to the cache lines over here. Same we have to do over here. We are invalid here. We have to do the read response. So we will go over to a shared information state here, and we will have shared information here. Here we can answer the request directly from that line, so we don't have to do anything. Over here we will change the value for B, so we will have to write. We look up when we reach the cache what value we have in there. It is still shared. So in that case we need to invalidate. It's just one, so it's no copy paste, it seems. Interesting. Okay, so we have to invalidate. This will lead to invalid over here, while we will make this one then first exclusive, but then in the end modified one, which is read over here because we are in invalid state. Here, as we have modified here, we realize that we have to answer with not with a read response, but with a write back, and go to shared one, and we will have write back over here and go to shared one. Notice there's also this the idea of having a memory around somewhere, but as the memory is not in some way or in any way modeled here, this won't reach this write back won't reach any event on the memory's process line. However, we could imagine that there's a memory process line also going over here, and this write back would also somehow, well, it would need to be somewhat like that, and be also a write back and reach the memories model. But you see, you can leave out certain components of these things depending on what you actually want to model. For some cases, for us, the memory in that case is a fire and forget thing. We never obtain anything from there, so I have left that away from that diagram. But that might change depending on what other situation we have there. You mean this one?
Yeah, exactly. We just override the old value.
Yeah. That's the kind of the same situation that we had in the table also. The thing is that in these machines, these cache lines are longer than just one variable. So in order to be able to change only that fraction of the cache line, we might at some point need to write back the whole line. So we still need the rest of the line, and that's what we obtain with the read. So that's something which is not covered directly in the diagram. It's flashy and colorful and all that, but it can't really. Well, I haven't done it in the detail that would actually be a complete x86 core, but we have to have this read and validate because cache lines are long and variables are short, and we patch one fraction of the cache line, but still need to write the whole cache line back. Mm-hmm. Good. Yeah, so you see the principle here, that's what we can do to bring this messy protocol and the messy states into our process diagram. We just annotate these things over there. Good. So, yeah. The what are properties over there? Well, you've seen that, but I don't know whether your attention was on that. There is this control dependency, another memory access can only be issued as at the time that the other one has finished. So there's control dependency, happened before dependency between these things, and this incorporates that the second write access needs to wait for the first one to finish in order to do so. So that is still a part of our model. So that's why there's a lot of these edges in there. Yeah, that's the thing that we have discussed. Okay, so all in all, that is the MESI protocol. The MESI protocol is there in order to make our memory model consistent, although we have components which decouple a lot of things, like these caches, which even copy values for of commonly addressable memory to each of these local memories. And yeah, so the sequential consistency can still be applied. We still are quite interested in that because that's our notion of well-behaved programs. And with the MESI cache coherence protocol, we can make sure that we can still emanate from a sequentially consistent system, even if we have caches in processes. So far, so good. That's already a certain level of CPU development that we have incorporated into our model up till now. So processes with caches is more than, for example, people at the which are dependent on these highly safety critical systems are able to do. There's these this idea of cache timings that mess with the correctness of your programs in safety critical environments. So people at some levels try to make sure that there's no nonsense going on by just turning off cache use all nodes. And yeah, that's severely punishing the runtimes of these systems. But well, you're correct in your computations then. Anyway, in our model, we have now incorporated caches also, and that's a good thing. However, there's still that's still not the kind of state of the art of how actual concrete computers are dealing with memory accesses, because it turns out that if you just keep to the MESI protocol in that way and the cache behavior in that way, you will end up with a lot of these interprocess relations there. And we have talked about this property that we have hardwired our happened before errors in there, so that only after the, for example, the invalidate acknowledge or mainly the invalidate acknowledge that we can continue with our main program, although we might be able to perform some other actions in the time while other cores are busy with trying to answer to our invalidation news, and we could have continued with some local computation at our current node. So the idea is, for more performance in this system, we need to somehow relax a little bit more in our constraints of how caches work together. And one idea is that you want to decouple the processes even more from each other by introducing store buffers, so that the local process can continue working with its local instruction set as soon as it has issued its intent to write to a certain thing and perform the actual writes locally, and the system itself may be able to buffer the time that or the effort that it actually needs to communicate to all the other cores that this information is out of date, and the local process can continue on. Then this is the concept of out of order writes, because with that you will get some weird behavior for if you look at what the global state of certain variables actually is. So the main problem of the whole thing was this performance problems. Writes always stall in the sense that writes always wait for the invalidate acknowledgement to actually be transported back. This means that we have read invalidates going out, we have read responses going out, and invalidate acknowledges going out. And these are each of the time, that's not, well, in our example, we only have two peers here that are communicating with each other. It's always CPU A and CPU B. However, in modern systems, well, for the laptops and notebooks and all that, you might still have something like two cores or something, but there's already smartphones that have 8 cores or something like that, and with that you need to make sure that the communication reaches all the peers. So there's a lot of messages going around, especially the invalidations need to be collected from all the peers that you're synchronizing with. So there's a lot of communication overhead involved in that, and the buzz is quite busy tossing out all these invalidation acknowledgement messages after you have actually invalidated a certain thing. And your local process has to wait for all of these acknowledgement to arrive before it can actually continue with computing. And that's one of the major bottlenecks that people have encountered with that sort of system design. And the idea to overcome that is, in many cases, it's problems where there's kind of one actuator and a lot of people who just observe a certain thing. So why shouldn't a CPU be allowed to continue executing if all there needs to be done is just collecting invalidation acknowledgements? So, yeah, the idea is to do so with a certain new addition to the processor design, particularly the store buffer, which is introduced as a new component between the CPU and the cache. And the idea is that the process that is modifying a certain variable is now putting its write access directly into the store buffer, and the store buffer is then performing the complete fetching of the cache line and performing the actual write, but only after the cache line has actually arrived. However, the main process is still being able to act and maybe tries to modify another memory cell, or maybe reads from something that it already has there locally. It doesn't matter. It's able to act again. So you have to imagine there's a kind of a shortcut without having to go through all the invalidation acknowledgements. This is instead now handled by the store buffer itself. Store buffers are in most known architectures actually queues. So these modifications are performed in the same sequence as they have arrived at the store buffer. So we can also talk about store queues. Right, the same locations are, well, at least in the information that was there in that document, they are not merged. However, you can also think of systems which merge information about the same memory locations. If they are written to twice, then there might be some kind of entity in there which then only keeps the most recent modification in there and just throws the other thing away. And well, with that, you can imagine it's quite chaotic to program if you don't pay attention to subsequent reads that might also go to the same memory line. So you must make sure that if you want consistency for your own process, you need to make sure that if the your own CPU issues read accesses to addresses that you have written to, you have to make sure that these reads also check the store buffer before they even go to the cache, and that's a lot of transistors that you have to invest for that. So that's needed to get kind of a local consistency, and on hit you would return the youngest value that has been has not been written yet to the cache, and if there's no information, you just go to the cache. So that is with this youngest value that makes an implementation that that merges same location writes unnecessary. But yeah, it depends on the actual implementation how you would do that. But for me, it seems that that is the way that's actually implemented. Anyway. If we have such a system where you have your store buffer organize all these the collections of the cache lines and the organization of the invalidation acknowledgments, you get properties that your local view on the memory is still consistent in terms of your own write accesses. However, it's not necessarily so that a write to a certain memory address is observable immediately for all the other processes that are around. However, that is kind of the model that is kind of state of the art right now for modern, for example, the XR86 or the Spark architectures. So yeah, that's quite a common model, and it's called TSO, which is this total store ordering. Okay, so what can you say about sequential consistency for such a system? So let's maybe introduce such a store buffer to our common example, and let's observe what's actually happening in such a system. So what can we say about this process diagram? We have yet another process line in there, which is this store buffer. And it's living, it changes there, so it gets its own process line. The caches are still existing like they have done before, so there are still these cache states around, and they carry value. The store is kind of a buffer, so it is a sequence of variable names and new values that are gonna go into these variables. So it's considered as being a list at a certain event, and when there's a new event, then it's a new list. So that's how the store buffer actually works. So for a diagram like that, how would we assume the whole thing to start? Well, that's what we can read from there. So cache A contains shared 0 for A. So shared 0. And B exclusive, 0. Cache B contains A's shared 0. And this needs to be invalid over there. The store buffer for now is just an empty sequence, so there's nothing living in there. So what's happening now to the whole system? There's the first write to A. Turns out that I have misplaced that a little bit. This should ordinarily go there, so sorry about that. Okay, what's happening there? Well, A is shared in the memory, so we need to communicate with other caches about the actual value of the whole thing. So it will, as there's communication necessary, we have new facilities for that. We have the store buffer. So what we will going to do there is we will store A1 in there, and then have our happened before relate to after this instruction. That's why it has to go one step to the left, and keep this A1 in our buffer. And we can continue with our program. So there don't need to be any communication yet. It's just the store buffer acts as soon as it decides that it's time to do so, when the message bus is not congested, or whenever it deems the whole communication to be appropriate. So you can't say for sure that it will immediately start with putting out messages. It might do so. It also might not do so. There might be conflicts on the message bus. Who knows? Anyway, we can. We don't have to wait for the result to be there. We can now just start with the next instruction, which is this B goes to 1. We have exclusive information about that here, so we can directly go to the cache. We don't need the store buffer. While we maybe have a hardwired check in there whether there is a pending write to B in there, but there's none, so we can go directly to the cache line and modify its value there. So we go to M1 over here, and let's see what else happens. We have here the check for B, which is it's going to an invalid cache line, so we will issue read. This will reach this one here, which will then go over to shared one, and it will communicate to the memory that there has been some changes via the write back. So remember, if we have a model line for the memory, we still need to connect another arrow to this one. Anyway, we have now communicated our change to there. You're just validating that. Okay, good. So we communicated that over here. So we will, can exit the while loop and check for A. And for this check, we need to go over here. We see we have a shared information here. It's 0. So, oh, bugger. Yeah, turns out that our assertion seems to be false here. So, yeah, that's what you get in a TSO. You're shaking heads. You're not. Okay. Yeah. So, that's what you get in such a system. Turns out that store buffers can delay their actual message delivery, and this one has done so. So over here, it has actually only then gone over to, well, the cache line is maybe, I'm not sure whether it's necessary to communicate with the cache line. Maybe check whether this is an exclusive thing, but anyway, what has to be done there is it has to communicate with the other cache that it needs to invalidate that thing, and it's only now invalid. And only then we can change that to modified 1 and have an empty store buffer. So yeah, that's what you get when you decouple these things. You have no happened before dependency between the invalidate acknowledgement. Thus, there's no dependency to this thing, which will lead to this whole other dependencies missing over here. So yeah. That's the consequences of that kind of model. So, bummer. Actually, it was quite a nice thing to have this decoupling, because we could continue working. However, it seems that it's not desirable in every situation. So, what is there as measurements to help us in that situation? Well, there's still ways to introduce arbitrary happened before relations by exclusively waiting for the actual delivery of an issued invalidation. And that's what an explicit instruction is for on such architectures. For example, on the x86, there is the so-called S-fence instruction, which is the store fence, S-fence, which is a write barrier. And its purpose is to actually perform an eviction of the store buffer, in the sense that it will perform all its invalidations, and we won't produce any other new content for that store buffer. And the S-fence instruction will only terminate as soon as the complete store buffer has been emptied and performed on our configuration. And only when it has finished with all its invalidations, only then the S-fence will continue the actual process. So that's what the S-fence is doing. It's a write barrier. And yeah, that's, I think, everything we have on here. Yeah. So in principle, that gives you the possibility to make sure that all your invalidate messages are going out in the system. And in principle, if you would be just after complete correctness, you can just issue S-fence instructions after every other instruction. So with that, you would spam the system with these write barriers and trigger the store buffer to be emptied after each instruction. However, if you do so, you will gain. The only thing is that you will have another operation or instruction to be executed after each of these, which will cost you a few cycles. And it will decrease system performance to the state that it had before you decoupled the whole thing. So this is your way back from these store buffer times to the times when you had just plain caches. So you lose a lot of potential if you do just a wild spam of these write barriers. However, you can make the program correct if you use these instructions on purpose at the right positions. So, for example, if you do that over here with the S-fence, you will have a similar similar situation as before, just with another S-fence in here. And notice you apply the S-fence over at thread A to afterwards make the assumption in thread B correct. So you have to actually a few insights into what you're actually doing if you try to apply these things. So you remember me drawing this blue line from the actual invalidate acknowledgement back to the continuation of the program A. That's now enforced with the S-fence. The S-fence will, and once again, I don't know what the layouting has gone through since last time, so this should actually be a little bit more over there. And the S-fence is the one which actually should trigger the store buffer to be emptied. So after this one, the store buffer is A1, and the S-fence now should trigger the store buffer to actually perform all its things. And only after the whole thing is empty, the S-fence will then return will return control to thread A, and only then it can continue with setting B to 1, which will then lead the synchronized thread B to actually be able to observe the change that has been done to A. So that is the way to patch the system in order to make it more consistent. Yeah, you can do so quite similarly with the other parts of this update. There's also the concept of an invalidation queue, which kind of introduces out of the order reads. And yeah, what's added here is there's also an invalidation queue now. So the invalidate queue is now between the cache and the memory, and how that will work out is, well, this introduces another process line at the communication partner, which is over at CPU B, which is the invalidation queue. And what can happen here is that your store buffer can communicate the invalidate to that particular invalidation queue, where it will send an invalidation acknowledgement and once again just enter this change into its own list. Over here it enters A should go to 1, and the other process B now can, well, the controller of the cache will at some point decide that it is time to execute this invalidate. Oh, sorry, I think it's only, it's invalidate, so it just doesn't need a value. So it just keeps A in there, and only at that point it will then set the whole thing to invalid. And yeah, I considering the time that we have left, I spare you the states in there, but if you need some practice, you can fill them out at home and yourself. What should be noted is that you will run into the same situation as we had before. You once again miss the actual assertion here and will hit another erroneous state if you just have these invalidation queues. And the S-fence from before doesn't help you in any way, because that only helps for the effect of the store buffer. If you also have invalidation buffers, the S-fence won't do anything. Instead, quite analogously to the case of the store buffers, with the store fence, you can also have a load fence, which is also part of the machine architecture there, and that acts as a read barrier, same way as the S-fence was a write barrier, and this will lead to the invalidation buffer to be flushed. So that's kind of the same deal. If you issue such an L-fence, then once again, I don't know why this is missing, but this L-fence triggers the invalidation buffer that has been loaded with, I think A it was. And over here it will empty. It will become empty, and only then it gives control back to the main process and allows for a termination of the whole thing. And yeah, in order to do so, you need to insert the load fence or the read barrier in this part of the algorithm, which is in thread B. So we have a store fence and a load fence, write barrier and read barrier. Yes? And that's exactly why this is a compiler construction topic. That depends on how your language is specified and what your compiler actually gives you as guarantees, or maybe even configuration possibilities. There's ideas of compilers which are kind of modular in the sense that you can configure what type of memory model you want to have, and the implication will be that either you have to live with kind of, for example, this total store order, where you have to make sure yourself that such situations will be resolved with placing these barriers manually, and you can do so in the usual compilers. You have these intrinsic methods. They differ from, well, if you go to C or C++ compilers, for example, they differ between the different architectures, different operating systems, and even brands of compilers. But you will find a similar instruction for either of the main things. I think the SFENCE thing is not exactly with that semantics, but with some kind of underscores and maybe even other prefixes or so, is like that in the GCC or even LLVM. I don't remember exactly.
How exactly does the CPU know that program supports this kind of memory model? Because there are obviously programs with
The CPU. Well, at least the ones that I know of can't really change the way that they interpret their memory accesses. They just have a kind of given memory model that they work with. And as a programming language designer, you specify to the programmer what kind of memory model you actually want to offer. And if it is a model that is higher than the actual hardware support, you have to automatically make sure that the behavior that is observable actually is matching the memory model that you promised.
So I can assume that any x86 processor behaves in
TSO, yes. Yeah, so that is the x86 has this TSO, and this means that if you don't put these things in yourself, and you're dealing with a language that doesn't say anything to with respect to the memory model, as the older C or C++ standards did, then you have to make sure that you add these things yourself. But there's higher level languages also available where they say they have sequential consistent behavior on the system, so they need to somehow make sure that such behavior is not observable, so they need to make sure to somehow order their writes in the right way. And there's this trade-off of either making your life easy as a program language designer and putting write and load fences, store and load fences everywhere in your generated code, or come up with some more intelligent way of fence placement in there. And there is algorithms that tell you where you can what the minimal distribution of fences over your code actually is, and that would be one of the topics that I would give as a sub, as one of these mini talks as thing. So if you're interested in that, I think that would suit your interests. Okay, so I think I've answered that probably. Good. So all in all, we're now at the site of more weakly ordered memory models. We don't have a strong order on the reads and writes between different processes anymore. However, we allow for much faster response times of certain instructions, so to say. So that's what we buy into if you go into these weakly ordered memory models. Of course, in order to get correct code, you still need to offer some measurements of how to deal with these things. And you have seen this mFence, or the fence instructions, which are combined into mFence if you want to do sFence and lFence at the same time. So this is just memory fence. There's also other things like the volatile keyword. Well, anyway, this keyword here will trigger special care in the compiler, so that for variable accesses where the variable is marked with volatile, then there will be automatic fences placed around accesses to these variables. So they will be automatically inserted in there. However, it's still quite a brute force way that they do it. They just, well, at least per default, they're just placed in there. There's even more intelligent ways of placing these automatically. The other way is to resort to inline assembler instead. So, yeah, that's another way to access these low-level synchronization facilities. Yeah, we have still a short amount of time, so there's an example that we can go through, which is the Decker algorithm on SMP systems. I will make it quick for you. I think we have something like that also in the tutorial, so it's just to give you a general idea of what level the algorithms have that deal with these problems. So the Decker algorithm is an algorithm for implementing mutual exclusion of common resources for two processes with busy waiting in that case. So the idea is to have shared access to flags that will deny or enable access of critical sections for you. So there's flags for process 0 and process 1, and then there's a turn variable which will actually manage whose thread's turn it actually is to enter the critical section. And it works the way that this algorithm has two copies of the same code, but just with the numbers switched around. So where we have 0 here, we will have 1 in the other, and where we have 1 here, we will have 0 in the other. So the idea is to first of all set the flag belonging to the own thread to 0 to kind of mark the interest of entering the critical section. Then we will check racially whether the other thread will actually has interest to enter the whole thing. And now it depends on what the actual value of the turn variable is in case the other process also had interest to enter the critical section. So depending on the value of that variable, we will stop to flag our interest in there and will perform a busy wait on the turn variable. And only if there's a change observable in there, we will reflag our own interest. And in case the turn variable has been actually in our favor over here, we have, so to say, entered the critical section. And only in the end, we will say, in order to make the whole system fair, we should also let the other one participate in accessing the critical section, so we will set the whole thing as the other's turn, and we will deflag our interest. So that is the idea of the algorithm, and it of course needs a peer at the other thread's ID. So we will have for thread 1, we will have the same thing in a kind of mirrored way, where we will just swap around all the IDs for the threads. So that is a very basic algorithm. You can imagine that that's not something that you will want to implement in a high-level algorithm, but that's more for a very basic machine near programming, and that's things that might be hidden somewhere in the runtime or something which is very low level, but which you might be involved in doing when you actually perform when you actually do compiler construction. And yeah, that's just a description of what we have seen so far. And you can imagine that in such an algorithm, it's actually crucial that there's no races between the participating variables. So you must make sure that changes to variables actually are visible to the other part of the algorithm. So in this sense, you need to insert memory barriers. And well, that's the algorithm, how it looks like when you have annotated it with the appropriate things. What you need to do is you need to insert a load memory barrier in front of every read from a common variable and a write memory barrier after writing a variable that is read in the other thread. And you can combine them in case that they are one after the other and make an M fence out of that. And if you do so, you will end up with a consistently behaving system. And we will do so in the tutorial session at some point, I think. So you can play around and try it out and see misbehavior or non-misbehavior depending on how we will annotate these things. So all in all, resuming, memory barriers are quite low-level means of synchronization, but all in all, they're, if you do kind of protocol implementation on a very low level, if you encode automata that have to communicate certain protocols with each other by synchronizing their transitions, then something like the barrier solution is quite a nice thing. It's quite often used in operating systems, for example, for these very basic operations. They might not be so appropriate if you do high-level things, and especially in many cases where you would just hit the pattern of a lock or mutex or any high-level synchronization means. In such cases, you're just writing error-prone code and probably don't get any better performance than you already do for your high-level implementation. So it's only a thing where a lot of time is lost in store and validate buffers, and you actually see that you don't need all that communication or synchronization on these things. So only then this is a really nice thing to do. We have also seen that volatile is the thing how to introduce that in C or C++. In the newer standards of C++, you also get the notion of these atomic variables, which will also have to do something with inserting memory barriers. And then there's also this idea of having high-level languages where you specify your program language on a more more consistent memory model than the actual bare metal gives you. So you have a certain gap that you have to bridge with automatic algorithms, which we haven't treated over here. So I think that's what you have seen the whole two lectures now, just once again repeated for you at home. So I think I'm, yeah, okay. A short sneak peek into what's actually also offered, because it's just not only dual processor systems out there. There's larger systems out there with even more processors. For these, you will get an augmented protocol called MESIV, where you have ways of getting rid of the congestion of read responses on the bus by having one dedicated cache controller being the one marked with F, which is supposed to be the forwarding cache controller, which is the one who is responsible for the for answers that have to do something with that cache line, so you don't get too much congestion due to read responses. But in general, as when you make these systems very, very large with very many processes, this won't be the solution what makes it the whole system scale. In fact, you will have to drop this shared memory system in favor of NUMA systems where you have non-uniform memory access, where you have several layers of responsibility in there, and this will lead to a whole network communicating with each other, where clusters can communicate quite cheaply, but whenever you bridge the way to another cluster, you have to actually pay quite expensively for retrieving information from there. But yeah, none of that is really the focus of that thing. I think if you have gotten the things with the total store order, the sequential consistency, the messy protocol, and all the the barrier things, I think you're already quite prepared for memory models on programming languages. So with that, I think we can go to references and conclude for today. I thank you for your attention, and hopefully see many of you on Friday morning at 8:30. So have a nice day and see you soon.